Is this because they live longer? Blaze stooped. He picked up a pebble and slung it over the flat water. It sunk without a single skip. They think they can just wait around for a god to billow orders from the clouds? Dante stared at the steep hill beyond the plaza. Skeins of smoke curled from its crown, venting the hearths of the homes in its side. Does encamping their warrior band in the middle of town strike you as unusually aggressive? The kind of thing you'd do when you want to provoke answers from someone who doesn't want to give them? Exactly. Maybe. Blaze skipped another stone. Can you really see them turning on each other? I don't know. The Norn aren't exactly a unified people. But they've hardly been clawing at each other's throats the last few years. Dante glanced upstream, where Morn was kneeling, but on his heels, and staring out over the water. Still, if waiting around is their only goal, there is plenty of non-town space for them to occupy instead. So, let's go feel the mare out for ourselves. What about our shadow? Blaze knew better than to glance at Morn. Point your finger at him and make him fall down. That isn't how it works.
Yes, it is.
All right, that's basically how it works. It was, in the scheme of things, a simple task, with no need for theatrics or even any blood to feed the nether. Dante squinted at the mossy rocks, the waves slurping through them. The nether pooled in his hand like the shadow of quicksilver. For Blaze's benefit, he pointed at Morn as one would point out a thief. The kneeling Norn leaned forward like a toppling tree, spilling face first into the grass. Wait, do you even know where the mayor's house is? Of course. When somebody tells me I can't come with them, the first thing I do is watch where they go. They headed back for the plaza. Light and laughter poured from the windows of the public houses. A longboat had pulled in during their walk along the shore, its crew beelining for the likeliest source of liquor. It provided more than enough cover for any noise Dante made skirting the square. Was he being paranoid? Orlin and V wouldn't let them up to see the mayor themselves. They'd assigned Moon to follow Dante and Blaze wherever they went, presumably as much to keep tabs on them as to ensure their own safety. But why let the pair of humans come along at all if the Norn chiefs didn't consider their presence useful? As usual, when dealing with the Norn approach to outsiders, Dante felt like he'd nodded off in the middle of a carriage ride and been dropped off in strange streets with no idea which way was north. He started up the switchback at a swift but unremarkable pace. Cave houses sat in the rocky face of the hill, doors cut to fill the irregular contours of the cave's natural mouths. Torch sconces projected from each side of the doors, some lit, illuminating the path ahead, and the family names painted in gorgeous runes above the entries. They climbed until Dante was panting and Kling lay below them in the haze of the river mist. Torches flickered around the salmon mosaic in the central plaza. Just ahead. Blaze nodded to a cave door, little different from the dozens below it or the handful above. It wasn't that late. Perhaps an hour past supper time. But Dante was suddenly aware of the questionable etiquette of barging in on a city official under dark of night. Blaze promptly resolved this dilemma by planting himself in front of the cherrywood door and knocking like the hand of death himself. Faced with the sudden prospect of confronting the mayor, Dante wished he could run right back down the hill instead. Positions of leadership in the Norn territories were filled through a process that baffled human commoners and horrified the nobles. In contrast to the process of power accumulation typical to human government, birthright, nepotism, wealth, and well-paid armed killers, Norn men and women were promoted to chieftaincies, mayordoms, and regional stewardships based solely on the public perception of and appreciation for their opinions. Not their political opinions, either. Nobody cared what a man had to say about taxes or trade or the distribution of the commons. Or anyway, if they did care, it wasn't over the political positions themselves, but rather for the theophilosophical reasoning that had led the leader in question to take those positions in the first place. Most of the time, it was even more abstract than that. Say a young woman appeared to live a noble, upright life among her clan. She also had bright, wise things to say about the Holy Scrolls and the right way to lead a well-lived life, and her deeds matched her words. These things would be noticed by her clansmen. Tucked away. And if a crisis struck, if the current chief died or went mad or had a philosophical revelation indistinguishable from madness, that bright, noble young woman might find herself elevated to the chieftaincy in the blink of an eye. How the public reached these decisions as to whose integrity was greatest and whose position was most convincing was as nebulous as it was sudden. Sometimes there was no open discussion at all, yet with less warning than a flash flood, a formerly beloved clan chief wound up replaced. Most perplexing of all, most leaders welcomed being replaced. To the Norren, leadership was a burden, a leaden net of unwanted responsibilities, judgments, arbitrations, and bureaucratic wheel-spinning that left them precious little time to pursue the highest virtues, arts, craftsmanship, and tribal warfare. Meanwhile, the few Norren who desired political office were typically those who lacked the brains to ever be granted it. Many of the most thoughtful spoke little at all, preferring to be thought of as mentally crippled rather than exposing the wisdom of their philosophies and thus putting them at risk of a sudden promotion to power. And the more cunning leaders, upon discovering firsthand how unpleasant the demands of the crown, scepter, or wolf's head could be, took to deliberately espousing theories of life and scripture that were flawed, flagrantly heretic, or outright nonsense, hoping to have the mantle snatched from their shoulders and draped over those of some other sucker. Often the public saw through these deceptions and played along anyway, in a stubborn effort to call the chieftain's bluff. The result was twofold. The policies of clans, villages, and territories could suddenly become bizarre or outright self-destructive, leading to regular turnover at the top and a widespread degree of low-level chaos that the regimented politics of the capital in Setevan found laughably easy to exploit, and which Dante found maddening to try to keep up with. And in the rare cases when a mayor or chief stuck fast to his or her position for years or decades, their realm might be stable, but the leaders themselves were often resentful and bitter of their responsibilities, sometimes poisonously so. The man who opened the door was one of the latter. Old even by Norren standards, grey coloured the mayor's head, brows and beard. He was lean, like jerky as lean, but had lost none of his 7'6" height to old age, or in any event had plenty to spare. As he towered 2 full feet above, Dante suddenly understood how it felt to be a dog that's just been discovered snatching up the roast. "Are you the mayor?" Blay said.
"Are you knocking on the mayor's door without knowing who the mayor is?"
"We're friends," Dante put in quickly.
"Doubt that. Don't often feel like taking a hammer to the heads of my friends."
"We're here to help. A clan of Norren was taken as slaves, and now they're gone, and the rest of us still got to look out for ourselves." The old Norren lowered his face inches from Dante's, filling him with the same vertigo that might come from being stared down by a mountain peak.
"Unless you're looking to become a part of my doorstep, get off it."
Blaze stood his ground. "If you change your mind, we'll be sleeping on your town's lawn." Something shifted in the old man's eyes. He closed the door hard enough to make Dante blink. Laughter trickled up from the plaza far below.
"He's got my vote," Blaze said.
"He's hiding something."
"Tall as he is, he could be hiding a pike up his ass and you'd never be the wiser."
That would explain the general tightness of his character. Dante kicked a pebble down the trail. It bounced awry, bouncing over the edge and clattering on the stone incline below.
He knows something. That's why the clan came here. That's what he meant about looking after themselves now.
Sounded like typical Noran fatalism to me.
I think he thinks talking would put him in danger. Maybe pose a risk to the whole town. If so, how do we make him talk?
I predict he's impervious to threats.
Physical ones.
A smile began to spread on Blaze's face.
Bribery? Blackmail? We don't even know the guy's name.
Then it's a good thing we have absolutely nothing better to do than plot and scheme to ruin his life.
I'm sure you're aware that tradition and logic dictate the best place to scheme is in a pub.
My thoughts exactly.
Wait, really? Dante nodded downhill. The lanterns of the public houses flickered over the sprawling stone mosaic.
If there is one thing you can always find in a pub, it's people willing to badmouth public officials.
We'll have to be careful not to draw suspicion. I'll disguise myself by getting drunk.
No less than 3 public houses stood in the square. Dante chose the loudest, a 2-story structure with a ground floor of clamshell-studded clay bricks that must have been fired from river mud.
Its upper level was unpainted pine boards. That, and a visible slant to many of its windows, marked the 2nd story as a later and somewhat hasty addition.
An old man poked at meat grilling over the fireplace. Scents of fish oil, beer, and sweat miasmed the wide room.
Though few humans peopled the Noran lands, the pub's patrons, like those of any decent port, were a diverse bunch, evenly split between human and Noran. The furniture didn't reflect this democratic spirit. Human legs dangled from chairs built for much larger bodies.
Blaze ordered while Dante found a promising seat at the end of a long table just high enough to make resting his elbows on it entirely awkward. The wooden bench was worn shiny and smooth from the butts of countless travelers. His pint was pleasantly bitter and just as cold as the wintry air outside.
Blaze bought a platter of steaming, flaky whitefish, nearly doubling the price with a side of extra salt.
Dante had expected the 12 Noran and humans at the table to begin criticizing, insulting, and slandering the mayor at a moment's notice. From their supple leather coats, they were native to the territories, if not Kling itself. But 3 pints, and an hour later, he had nothing to show for himself but a decent buzz.
Blaze seemed happy enough, chatting away with a shaven-headed Noran about various flavors of Noran beer, a topic which, given the hundreds of varieties of Noran wheat, they approached the cultivation of their staple crop with the same rigor and vigor they brought to their art, could fill a solid month of discussion, and Blaze gave every indication of doing just that.
"Excuse me," Dante finally said to the gray-bearded Noran to his right, "can you tell me who's mayor here?"
The man didn't look up from the chipped clay mug he'd been staring at the last 5 minutes.
"Why do you ask?"
With a drunk's skill for plucking up lies as easily as fallen scarves, Dante said,
"I'm looking to do some shipping here."
"You're not from here. It's obvious as a sunrise. So let me spare you the speeches about Mayor Banning, and say this. He's great. You couldn't ask for a better leader. Honest, forthright, a man who looks out for his town."
"I see. Put him in charge, what, 40 years ago?
Stoics of Parnassus. After he wrote that, they tried to put him in charge of the whole territory, but Kling wanted him too, hometown and all. Fought themselves a little war about it. Kling's victory inspired him to write, 'The posture of virtue is not kneeling.'"
"I've read that," Dante said. He argues that taking a stand against a stronger foe guarantees the eternal blessings of both Hopped and Jolson Joe. Very spirited.
The Norren eyed him, drawing back in the universal gesture of reappraisal.
Should try to take a look at his paintings if you get the chance. Landscapes so real you could tip them back and pour their rivers right into your mouth. Really? Where can I find them? Not his workshop, that's for sure, the old man laughed. He keeps that locked down tighter than the princess's panties. Couldn't even tell you where it is.
He gulped his beer.
Can't blame him either. He'd never get one stroke down with a crowd of gogglers pressing in over his shoulders.
Over the course of the night, Dante struck up conversations with the pub keep, another Norren local, and a trio of human bargemen who made regular call at Kling. On the starlit walk back to the tent, he detoured back to the river shore.
They all said the same thing. A man whose integrity and talent is matched only by his prolificness.
He spat beery aftertaste into the slow-moving waters.
I hope you came up with something more helpful.
Oh,
Blaze said. He reached down for a stone and wobbled, slapping both palms into the muck to steady himself.
That.
That.
I sort of forgot why we were there.
He attempted to wash his hands in the river and fell down again, soaking his pants.
I think I need to go to sleep.
Dante sighed and headed to the tent, where Blaze proved himself right by collapsing into his blanket, where he stayed until well past noon. The clan was similarly indolent, fishing, napping, sketching circles in the mud, where they lit candles and knelt to pray to Jolson Joe for direction. Dante, turning to more earthly forms of action, decided to follow the mayor. Technically speaking, he wasn't following Mayor Banning. A dead fly was, but Dante had killed it. Three, actually, but the first two were too mangled to use. Revived it of a sort, and sent it after Banning the moment the mayor lumbered from his cliffside home. Seeing through the fly's eyes was so nauseating, Dante puked his guts up all over the shoreline reeds, where a hungover Blaze had had the same idea. Unlike the sights and sounds he received from dead animals, which were essentially the same as, if sometimes sharper than, his own, the senses relayed from the fly were kaleidoscopic and chaotic. A fractured, fisheye view of the world that careered into stomach-stirring anarchy the moment the insect took wing. The only way Dante could keep up was to lie down in the darkness of the yurt with his eyes closed and a cloth over his face, a posture which Blaze imitated after just a few minutes of trying to battle the shimmering sunlight mirrored on the blue waters. Through the fly's manifold eyes, he watched Banning take meetings with merchants, have lunch with his wife, have more meetings with merchants, followed by a meeting with a mayor from downriver, and finally with another pair of merchants, whom he spoke with over dinner and wine, before retiring home to read scriptural scrolls in the candlelight. The next day, during negotiations with a landlord from upriver over the prospect of floating his timber through Kling, Banning rose and smashed the fly into a gooey blot. Dante's second sight disappeared with a pinprick of pain in the center of his brain. Citing exhaustion, he sent Blaze to catch him a new fly, which he had back in action by mid-afternoon. Just in time to watch things conclude with the would-be timber baron, whose proposal was denied on the grounds it might interfere with local fishermen. For 3 days, Banning did nothing but rise, meet, eat, and read. On the fourth day, rather than descending the switchback to his offices on the short hill on the north end of town, the towering Norren climbed to the very top of the rise in which his house was set and continued west into the woods. He wandered along as if aimless, gazing at sunbeams, kneeling to brush leaves from stones. After a few hours, during which Dante nodded off more than once, Banning trudged to a fold in the hills where a small, simple cabin hid among the thick trees. The mayor knocked on the door. A young Norrin appeared, smiling, and handed Banning a wide, flat object bundled in cloth. Paint smeared his hairy arms. Dante opened his eyes and went to get Blaze.
"He doesn't paint his own paintings," he explained. "He doesn't have time.
He's so busy running the town's affairs that he has some kid do it for him, then picks them up when they're done."
"So what?"
Blaze picked pulled chicken from his teeth, still traumatized from their days-long march of crusty bread. He'd made it his mission to try the fare of every stall, inn, and bakery in town.
"Every master in Bressel does that."
"We're 1,000 miles from Bressel. To the Norrin, the things you make are a reflection of your soul. That's why it's such a big deal. Passing off someone else's work as your own is like plagiarizing the cycle of Aron.
A great way to get lynched by humorless scolds?
And to get him to talk. Now, he's miles from town. We can catch him on the way back."
"What about him?"
Blaze nodded at Morn, who idled at the bakery across the plaza, crumbling bread into his mouth. Out of shame or confusion, the young Norrin hadn't mentioned suddenly falling asleep the other night, but he hadn't ceased following them either.
"Let him follow. If Banning tries to kill us, we'll have a witness."
Blaze went back to the tent for his swords. While he was gone, Dante sat down and closed his eyes. Banning was still in the woods to the north, traipsing Klingward with the help of a tall staff, a package tucked gently under his other arm. Dante didn't bother fetching his own sword. He doubted Banning would attack them outright, whether in feigned outrage to their accusation or to stop them from telling others. But if Dante was wrong, and given how seriously the Norrin took these things, there was always a chance, his middling swordplay wouldn't be much use against the towering mare. They puffed their way up the switchback road, then followed the dirt trail traced across the hill's flat crest. Morn lagged 100 feet behind, but once the trail gave out and the two of them cut across the high brown grasses of the open field, the young Norrin jogged to catch up, his face dark with annoyance at being forced to run after his troublesome human charges.
"Where are you going?" Morn said when he reached their side.
"Our daily stroll across the middle of nowhere," Blaze said.
"You're not supposed to leave town."
"And my mother didn't want me to grow up a swordsman like my dad, either. But that didn't stop me from disgracing her dearly departed memory."
"Turn around and get back to your tent."
Dante scowled over his shoulder.
"If you'd like to try to stop us, please let me know where to send your remains. Now go back to town and beseech Joson Joe to tell you what to do next. It's worked great so far."
"Joson Joe's words are real."
Morn's voice sounded so hurt, Dante almost stopped.
"You've heard him?"
"Not me, personally. V and Orland do most of the talking."
"Then how do you know they're not making it all up?"
"Some summers ago, the clan headed to the Highlands to wait out the heat. The peaks are high and jagged there, ready to tear open the belly of any stupid and lazy clouds who get too low. But it was dry there, too, because sometimes the gods hate us. And who can blame them, when every smart lad in the land is ready to denounce their very existence?"
Morn waited a moment before going on.
"We were gathering gen nuts when Orlin went stock still. Joson Joe had spoken to him, he said. There was a fire past the western ridge. We needed to move. We travelled east. Within an hour, the fire jumped over the ridge and swept over the valley where we'd been earlier that morning. Maybe we'd have had enough time to get away, but we were on foot like always, and fire can outrun any man when it's hungry enough."
"Orlin probably smelled smoke," Dante said.
When Joson Joe spoke to him, the wind was blowing westward.
So he saw the smoke? Fire has a unique property of being visible.
Morn tromped through the weeds in silence. At least tell me where you're going.
Blaze touched the pommel of the sword at his hip.
Oh, just to kick the mare until the stars wearing around his head show him the sign to tell us where the hell your cousins are.
I think V hates me, Morn declared. Why else would she assign me to you two?
Maybe she hates us.
It's a stupid thing, really. You're running off to God's nowhere, and what am I supposed to do to stop you? Attack you? I don't think any good will come of that, except for the local worms. So I'm supposed to run off and tell Mommy and Daddy like a spited toddler?
Morn shook his head at the state of things.
You know what? To hell with them. If they want to guard you, they can guard you themselves. We're beating up the mayor. Let's go beat up the mayor.
The hill sloped down into a low forest of birches and young pines. Star-shaped yellow flowers dotted the roots of the trees. Dante shut his eyes to glance through the flies, and tripped into a pile of pine needles. Smelling sap, he kept his eyes shut.
Are you okay? Morn said. I think he's dead.
I'm not dead.
In the fly's fractured vision, dozens of bannings hiked up the side of a hillside more or less identical to their own. He ordered the fly up, stomach lurching. He managed to prevent himself from puking until the bug had located them among the trees, confirming the mare was no more than half a mile away. When Dante was finished, he kicked pine needles over the hot, sour mess, gargled with cool water, and gestured down the hill.
Stop staring at me and start looking for our man.
They need hardly have bothered. Within a minute, Banning began singing to himself, an eerie, droning tune that carried down the hillside like the honking of morbid geese. When Dante stepped in his path, the spire-tall Norrin stopped less than a foot away. Dante tensed, preparing to fling himself out of the way.
I know you.
Banning's face darkened.
Just because the cliff isn't here doesn't mean I won't throw you down it.
You should at least hear what I'm about to say, Dante said. Then some people might even not blame you for what you've done.
Talk sense or talk less.
That package under your arm, is your name on it?
Banning didn't glance down.
It's the last stroke I made.
Typical of most artists, I imagine.
Except, apparently, the man who actually paints yours.
The mayor's gaze was as still and deep as a lake.
Pick up a weapon.
Dante cocked his head. What?
So I don't have to say I killed an unarmed man.
Sudden anger rippled through Dante's veins. With it came the nether, great pools he gathered in his hands. With a thought, he shaped them into shadowy ropes which looped around the tree branches and clawed at Banning's rugged face. The air dimmed like an instant sunset. Dante gave form to the nether for those who couldn't see it, viscous, liquid shadows that dripped from his hands like reluctant blood.
I could have threatened you with violence, he said softly, but I could tell at a glance it wouldn't work. And I've had to either back down or hurt you, which I don't much like to do. But if you don't answer my questions about the missing Norrin, I will tell the city where your masterpieces really come from. You'll be exiled from Kling to die as an old man in a place you do not know.
Anger flowed over Banning's face, followed by a quiver of fear that was clearly visible beneath his thatchy beard.
If someone were to have up and enslaved a clan, you think their fellow Norrin would be happy to point those people out?
Unless?
Unless saying such would threaten the ones that they hold dear.
I see.
Maybe even an entire town.
Dante let the taut branches relax. The shadows faded from his hands.
Then I'll put myself on the line, too. I'm from Narashtavik. I'm the agent of Callimandicus, highest priest of Aron. I'm here to help.
Narashtavik is part of Garsk like anywhere else.
And if the capital finds out we're here, we'll be invaded the minute they're finished with you.
Banning slung the wrapped painting onto the forest floor.
Tell them anything you like. I don't give a damn about my reputation. I don't know who took your people or who they sold them to.
He stepped on the package. The wooden frame cracked beneath its weight.
But I do know who took them downriver.
Who?
You give me your word.
Dante nodded. No one will know who told me. The old man grinned, a savage thing that bristled his beard like a wall of thorns.
Oh, I want the ones who did it to know. What I want you to promise is you'll scream my name before you kill every last one of them.
Chapter 3. Haggling for the barge drained Dante's patience as hard as the days-long process of watching Banning's meetings. Before he could even begin to bargain with the captain, Dante first had to convince Orlin and V that hiring a boat was necessary to begin with, a requirement that seemed self-evident to him. When your quarry is river pirates, you won't have much luck hunting them down on foot, but which took the better part of the night to hash out. By the next morning's walk to the docks, he was ready to give up on talking and try hitting instead.
River pirates.
It was simple enough that Dante considered it a major blow to Jocen Jo's credibility that the Mercurial God hadn't passed that info along directly, rather than shooing them in the vague direction of a recalcitrant old man. But once Banning had been ready to speak, he'd spoken like he might never have the chance to speak again. The slave ship had docked in Kling just over a month ago. The dockhands had seen the eyes glittering from the darkness below decks. There'd been talk in town, when the pirates debarked, of slaughtering them then and there, but none of the captives were known to be family of anyone in Kling. And it had been pointed out that these weren't just a slapdash rowboat of common pirates, but the Bloody Knuckles, a multi-vessel armada headed by the three-decked galley, the Ransom. The last village to threaten the Bloody Knuckles had been so thoroughly robbed, raped, murdered, and torched that 6 years later the only remnant of the settlement were the cinders of its dead and the nightmares of their relatives. And so a conspiracy of silence had been enacted by the town of Kling, or those few who knew about the slaves anyway, a short list including the dockside witnesses, Banning, and a handful of the port's elders and most highly feared warriors, which Banning didn't break until witnessing Dante summon the Nether from the forest floor. In that moment, he decided the Clan of the Nine Pines and its two human allies had a real chance to wipe out the Bloody Knuckles in a single blow.
If only Dante could afford a boat.
In theory, he had access to the full treasury of the sealed citadel of Narashtavik. The city had grown substantially in the last few years, propelled by Kali's new policies and the refugees from the war with Malin, who, finding abandoned homes available for the taking in the city's outer rings, had flocked by the thousands to the foreign city, bringing new businesses, trade routes, and labor in equal measure. Despite Kali's covert funding of the operations in the Norrin territories, the city was rich by any objective measure. In practice, Dante couldn't just sign his name to a receipt of credit for the same reason a traitor can't stroll into the palace with a smile and a wave. Strictly speaking, he was a traitor. To Garsk, anyway. He had plenty of silver cashed in their base of Norrin operations in Dunrun, but that was 150 miles overland in the wrong direction, and even on the horses he couldn't afford, Making that trip would set them back at least a week on a venture that was already weeks behind. He and Blaze had enough on their person to buy decent lodging and board for a couple of weeks apiece, but that was hardly enough to rent a boat and its crew for a journey of 200 miles or more, with a passenger manifesto of some 30 armed warriors. The clan, meanwhile, had essentially nothing, with the exception of an armory of immaculately forged swords, which were priceless in the very real sense they refused to sell them. In the end, Dante had to resort to requesting credit from Banning, who agreed readily, going so far as to refuse all offers of repayment, be they sooner, wealth recouped from the pirates, or later, the weeks it would require to get word to Cali and hard funds. By the time all this was arranged, the crew of the Boomer was already drunk, and Captain Varlan, a stout man whose barrel-shaped body looked like it could serve as a ship of its own if properly hollowed, showed unusual concern in insisting they not shove off until the crew slept off their rum, wine, and beer. Dante boiled with the specific annoyance of a delayed journey. To occupy his mind, he practiced with the nether inside the yurt, forming images of Blaze falling off a variety of cliffs, treetops, and towers. Morn woke him shortly after dawn, and they tramped down the pier to the Boomer, a nondescript grain barge with a flat bottom and a single deck, below which spilled wheat was lodged into every corner and cranny. The clan, evidently confused by the concept of boats, set about erecting their tents below decks while Captain Varlan shouted the vessel into open water. A solid sheet of grey clouds tarped the sky. A low wind rippled the sails, chilling Dante at the side railing, where he watched them depart from Kling. On the receding docks, men lugged bales and barrels from and into waiting ships. The steep hill rose behind town, pocked with doors, slashed from top to bottom with the zigs and zags of its seamless, perfect road. Varlan nudged the barge to the middle of the river, clearing them from the port town's miasma of river muck and feces. Kling disappeared behind a bend. Dante had always wanted to take an extended trip via water, but he was soon glad he hadn't. In a word, it was boring. In another word, it was repetitive, a slow-scrolling vista of shoreline trees, short hills, and sudden cliffs with rocky piles collected at their bottom. Shacks dotted the banks every mile or three. Every few hours the current pushed the Boomer past a Norrin village, their high conical roofs designed to keep the snow off, jabbed from the shores like pins in a knitter's cushion. For 2 days, this was all Dante saw, and though he wasn't one to bore easily, the trip was doing its best. His condition wasn't helped in the slightest by the clan warriors, who continued to treat him and Blaze like off-duty farm dogs, fed occasionally, otherwise ignored, despite the fact that, if not for them, the clan would still be sitting on a muddy bank waiting for their one-eyed god to stop chasing female mortals long enough to clue them in about where to go next. When he'd brought up that very point, Orlin had brushed it off. Josin Joe had sent them to the right place, he said, but left it up to them to find what they'd come for. The exception was Morn, who now spoke to them regularly, readily answered questions, and generally showed all the signs of having abandoned his task of minding the two humans. Possibly because they were trapped on a boat, where the only opportunities to sneak off into trouble involved getting very wet. Still, Dante thought Morn's shift in priorities was genuine. "Somebody do something already," Blaze said from his seat on an out-of-the-way portion of the deck. "I'm so bored I'm about to start counting my own fingers."
"You have 10, Morn said.
"Don't be so sure. I've been drumming this deck so hard I might have worn some of them down to the nub." "You could try watching for pirates," Dante said.
"Oh, look! There aren't any."
"Try napping. You're cranky enough."
Blaze pounded his fists on the deck.
But I don't want a nap.
Dante laughed. We could tell stories. That actually doesn't sound horrible. He glanced up at the overcast sky, whose threats of rain had gotten as tedious as the scenery. What about this quaking bow? It would be very nice to have some idea exactly why we're sailing after a band of professional murderers on this terribly fearsome wheat bucket.
The quivering bow.
I don't care what it's called. I care about a graphic recounting of all the things it's destroyed. Dante gazed at a grey granite cliff, its face striated with white. I'm not sure I know any true stories. Some legends, perhaps. I don't care if it's true or false. All I want to hear is how a bow convinces a castle to blow up. Mourne lowered himself from the barge railing to sit on his heels.
Tell him about how the quivering bow got made.
Dante shrugged. I don't know how the quivering bow was made.
Everyone knows how the quivering bow got made.
I didn't grow up in Gask, Mourne. I hadn't even heard about the quivering bow until a year ago.
Then I'll tell him how it was made. And you. Wouldn't do at all for you to have the thing, and not have any idea what went into making it. Is that a human thing, rushing off to use things up without caring where they came from?
I think it's a Blaze thing, Dante said. Blaze pressed his palm against his forehead. Right, now, the Blaze thing is praying you both die if you don't get on with it.
You should pray for yourself to die, Mourne said. Then you'd get to do something really interesting.
He cleared his throat and frowned down at his hands, which he'd placed palms down on the hard wood deck.
I'll take a wild guess that you haven't heard of Corwell, either. Thought not. He's only the half-son of Margon, brother of Jocin Jaw himself. The first thing I would ask is why Corwell is half-mortal. But then again, I wouldn't need to ask because I actually have an education.
Blaze rolled his hand through the air. Get on with it before your education and your body that holds it find themselves at the bottom of the river.
Margon had a thing for Norrin women. The bigger the better. I think this is because he was a small god. Small like you, I mean. This meant he had nimble fingers and was very good at making clocks and flutes, and in picking the locks of sleeping Norrin women, which he did. A year later, Corwell was born. Corwell, being half-mortal, wasn't allowed in the heavens. Kind of for the same reasons you're not allowed to speak to Orlan, really. Instead, he grew up among the Norrin, where he used his Norrin strength and divine quickness to become an archer so fine he could shoot out a hawk's eye from so far away the hawk couldn't see him. This won the heart of Velia, a woman, everyone agreed, was the most beautiful Norrin born in 7 generations. They married. They were happy. But Margon wasn't, because Corwell had gotten to Velia before he could. So, he crept into their house one night and stole her, which, can I pause for a moment? That's not really acceptable in any form. A dad's supposed to be an example for his sons. I don't think anyone wants their sons to grow up to be a kidnapping rapist.
Maybe he just wanted to keep the family business alive, Dante said.
I would guess he was just selfish, but to each his own. Naturally, Corwell found it as despicable as I do, but couldn't do anything about it because Margon lived in a tower of solid iron with a top so high it was lost in the clouds, and the tower itself stood on a mountain so high it makes you too dizzy to stand. Corwell only made it up because he was half god, but as much as he pounded on the tower's walls, he couldn't leave a scratch. It just gonged like a giant bell, resounding through the clouds, which was probably a good thing, because when Corwell, in his completely relatable despair, flung himself from the mountain, his uncle, Jocelyn Joe, had already been drawn there by the bell, and was able to catch him. Jocelyn Joe offered to help, because, unlike Corwell's own father, he is a man of principles and upright character. Plucking a seedling from the base of the white tree, he bent it into a bow, stripping its leaves. This was a fairly normal tree, unlike its hideous progenitor, to be tied into a fan. He gave these to his nephew and told him the tower's outer wall was invincible, but that it was just a shell around a very normal stone structure. If Corwell could fire an arrow through the single window just below the tower's peak, he could strike the inner stone, sending the whole thing crumbling down. So Corwell went back to the Iron Tower and called to his father, Margon, who didn't even bother to come out and explain himself, which again shows you what kind of man he was. Corwell waved the fan, blowing away the clouds. He drew back his mighty bow and sighted in on the window, which was just a black speck so tiny you couldn't even see it, let alone shoot an arrow through it. In fact, it was so far away, it took a full minute after he released his arrow for it to fly right through the distant window. Once more, the tower rung like a bell. Its note was so strong it knocked the birds from the sky. Half the mountain slid into the sea, which probably killed a lot of people if anyone lived on the nearby islands. And the tower itself crumbled, dashing down in a hellstorm of thudding stone and screaming iron. Horrified that everyone in it was dead, Corwell waved his fan, flushing the dust out to sea, and found Velia alive under the broken body of his father. Morn frowned again at the backs of his hands. Which sounds like a happy ending, except when you think about it, Corwell killed his own dad, and Velia was abducted and ravished by her husband's father, which he couldn't have been too happy about either. But that's how Corwell got the quivering bow, and at least nobody ever bothered him or his family again.
Neat, Blaze said. No one will want to mess with us then, either.
Now do you see why we're after it? Dante said.
Sure. Sounds like we'd be invincible. So why not go after the Hammer of Tame while we're at it, or find a way to catapult the sun straight into Setevan?
Origin stories are always exaggerated. If you don't buy Morn's, I know one I think actually happened.
I wasn't just making that up, Morn said.
All I'm saying is,
these are things we believe in, you know. I don't know where you're from that you don't even pretend to take them seriously. But it must be a rude place, many shoving-related deaths.
Dante glared off at the cliffs drifting by at the speed of the current.
I don't know what's true and what isn't. If the bow's real, then maybe Corwell's story is too, along with the one I've heard. It's about a Norren named Wenworth, who only died about 50 years ago, so...
Wenworth the Mole died 56 years ago.
It's at least reasonably trustworthy. In short, Wenworth was a Norren warrior exiled from his clan after his younger brother convinced them he'd burned down their ancestral shrine, but his brother stole some of the relics from the shrine and sealed them up in a stone tomb. A tomb in which his treachery would soon cause him to be interred. It began from jealousy. Wenworth and his brother Bode were sons of the chieftain, and Wenworth, as the elder, was naturally in place to...
All hands!
Captain Varlan bellowed from the barge's aftercastle.
All hands take arms!
A sailor leapt on the mainmast, climbing hand over hand up the rigging. Others rushed for the ship's bow, or passed around spears stored in a closet on the face of the stern's castle. Dante rose and peered across the grey waters. Small waves smacked the hull. The men called back and forth, adjusting sails, swinging the boomer starboard and angling it at the eastern shore. Norrin warriors swarmed up the ladder from below decks. Dante and Blaze exchanged a look, then jogged to the bow and up the steps of the aftercastle, where Varlin relayed orders to a bald, gnomish old man, who in turn barked them to the crew in a voice far larger than his wiry body would seem to allow. "What's happening?" Dante said to the barrel-chested captain.
"Someone's distracting me from my duties,"
the captain said. "If you think you see pirates, we need to know."
"No pirates."
"That's good," Blaze said.
"Just the bodies they left behind."
Varlin nodded across the river and resumed jabbering at the gnomish man. Upriver, near the far bank, something flat yet jagged floated a short distance from the shore, a plane interrupted by sudden snagging upthrusts of snapped wood.
"Is that a shipwreck?" Blaze said.
The captain nodded.
"Then what are we doing sailing away from it?"
"Avoiding a trap."
The burly man pointed to a steep rise, its top lightly wooded, where the river curved downstream.
"Such as a man left ashore on yonder hill with a signal mirror, ready to flash the vessel hidden around the bend."
"So what? We've got to check it out."
"Anything worth taking's already been took by the ones that burnt their ship."
Blaze rolled his eyes. "To help the survivors."
"That isn't part of our mission," Dante said.
"Our mission is to help the people of these lands. When you're brought to Aron's hill in the sky, don't you want to be able to point to a few good deeds to balance out all the killings?"
"Aron doesn't judge."
"Well, he should. And we should, too."
Blaze turned to Varlin.
"Take us to the rack."
"That thing looks days old. The only comfort they'll need is a burial."
The blocky man rubbed his stubble.
"Well, you're paying for this trip. But one whiff of anything fishy and we're shoving off."
"Cowardice isn't a free meal," Blaze said. "It isn't something we should be lining up for."
He turned on his heel, brushing shoulders with Orlan, who joined them on the aftercastle. Dante followed Blaze down the steps. The gnomish sailor roared out new orders. Men clambered the rigging, tacking the sails to swing the barge larboard. Blaze set up position on the bow, swords sheathed. Morn procured a bow and hastily strung it. As they neared the wreckage, Dante kept one eye downstream for enemy boats, but the waters were empty, grey as the clouds. The wreck, it turned out, wasn't drifting so much as lodged in the rocks and mud 10 yards from the shore. Its hull stopped a few feet above the water, charred and broken. Submerged white sails flapped in the currents like bleached seaweed. Wood creaked on rocks. Soot and rot rolled over the clammy, muddy smell of the river. Varlin anchored and set his crew to preparing the boomer's single life raft, which had just enough room for Dante, Blaze, and 2 sailors manning the oars. Though the wreck was as silent as the clouds, Morn crouched over the boomer's rails, bow at the ready, joined by a dozen other warriors of the clan. 2 crewmen dipped their paddles into the cold water and pushed the rowboat forward. The tiny vessel rolled on the waves, swells thudding hollowly against its wooden sides. The deck of the wreck angled from the waters. One of the rowers reached for the damp railing and guided the rowboat in. They tied off, startling a crowd of crows, who hopped further down the ship and resumed pecking at the blackened arm tangled in a wrist-thick rope. Dante crawled past the crewman, grabbed onto the railing, and eased onto the slant of the deck, boots slipping on the slick wood. He braced himself and gave Blaze a hand up. A few feet to the right, where the deck met the water, a pair of legs lay on dry wood. The man's upper body swayed in the water, shirt billowing around his bruised and pale skin. Dante crouched down, breathing through his nose.
"This does not look good."
That's because it's a wreck, Blaze said.
Anyway, it doesn't matter if they're all dead. The important thing was coming here to check.
Well, look at you. I'm surprised you could coax that high horse into the middle of a river.
Sorry to interrupt all the beatings, threats, and killings to help someone for a change.
Down sails and charred, shattered wood blanketed the deck. Reddish-brown ovals stained the canvas. Blaze curled a rope around his forearm and used it to brace himself as he half-climbed, half-walked up the deck toward the stern, where an open hatch gaped into darkness. He leaned over its edge, wrinkled his nose.
If smells can kill, I hope you're ready with my eulogy.
He unwrapped the rope from his arm and slid it down the canted deck to Dante.
I'd be honored. You are an overweight nun with a drinking problem, right?
Dante coiled the rope around his arm and scrabbled up the creaking planks. At the hatch, the stink of fresh death churned his gut. Water lapped gently in the darkness. Still clinging to the rope, Dante rolled onto his back, rooted through his pack, and emerged with a dull, semi-opaque marble. He rubbed the torchstone between his palms, periodically blowing on it as if it were a colicky fire, until a strong, pale light bloomed from the stone. Dante leaned over the hatch rim and lowered the stone into the gloom. Ropes, broken casks, and shards of pottery scattered the planks some 15 feet below. Bodies lay propped against pillars or crushed between barrels. His nose already acclimating to the sense of decay and exposed guts, Dante smelled old smoke, coppery blood, and the sharp, irritating tang of oil. From the darkness beyond the stone's reach, something stirred the broken jars. Dante jolted back from the hatch, scrabbling to catch himself on its edge before he slid down the deck.
There's something down there. A cargo hold has cargo? This is a discovery right up there with fire.
Something alive.
Oh.
Blaze gazed down at the opening, as if suddenly regretting the entire venture, then grabbed the rope, scooted toward the deck railing, and started knotting.
This river just has fish in it, right? Nothing with tentacles.
I feel like a large tentacled object will pretty much go wherever it pleases.
Why do I always forget to bring a trident?
Blaze tested his knot with a tug, then slung the rope's free end down the hatch. It struck the bottom with a damp thud. He gestured down the pit.
Well, you've got the light.
Dante frowned at the gloom. I could just hand it to you.
Too much work. Get climbing.
Dante scowled, clamped the stone between his teeth, and grabbed hold of the rope. For all he'd seen and done, the fights, the battles, the deaths, he was still afraid of the dark. Not in a rational way, either. He was less scared of whatever was really down there than of all the things that couldn't be. The venomous monsters, the clawed horrors, the spider-faced giants that would lurch from the darkness the moment he turned his back. But this wasn't a fear he could voice to Blaze, so he lowered himself hand over hand into the damp, chill gloom. As the rope swung with his weight, Dante glanced frantically from corner to corner, splashing the hold with the stone's white light. It rushed over shattered wood, burst barrels, bubbly green glass. His boots touched the floor. He shuffled through the debris towards a chest-high crate that was gouged but intact, then hunkered down and pressed his back against it.
"I'm down," he called.
Feet dangled through the hatch. Blaze leapt straight down, the rope threaded through his elbows, slowing him just enough to stave off injury when he thumped to the planks. The boat groaned, grinding on the rocks, broken glass jangling in the darkness. Blaze threw his arms out for balance, and the ship settled into a new angle of rest.
Possibly not a great idea.
Not unless you're trying to drown. In which case, please ask me first.
Dante glanced up the sloping boat. At the grey limits of the Torchstone's reach, a man lay face down beneath a mass of loose barrel staves and hoops. Other than Blazer's disturbance of the rubble, Dante hadn't heard anything since descending, besides the